I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Ask me anything. I have a bunch of questions here from viewers, listeners, readers, fans, and I'm going to just go through them and try and do my best to answer them. And people have asked me questions about favorite foods and stuff like that, but also I think some hard questions. The first question I got is, what are my thoughts about what's happening in Texas? Texas has been absolutely devastated by cold weather. Now, Texas doesn't usually have cold winter weather. It's pretty far to the south. It's generally very mild. And therefore, given the weaknesses of liberal democracy, representative democracy, there's a tendency to not prepare for emergencies. Now, I used to live in Atlanta, which has lots of problems. And Atlanta's many, many black mayors that they've had for decade after decade never made any real serious contingency plans for snow and ice storms, even though about every 10 years there'd be a snow and ice storm and it would shut Atlanta down. And I remember years ago, it was back in the 90s, I was snowed and iced in, no power for several days. I had nothing but a medium-sized cat to keep the apartment warm. It was miserable. It was miserable. And the fact is that if something happens regularly, there's no reason not to plan for it, right? Just because it happens infrequently, but regularly, there should be planning. But when you have representative democracy and you have short terms, 4 years, 6 years, whatever, chances are that the next big snow and ice emergency that hits Atlanta will fall on somebody else's watch. And so the people who run that city just punt. And so everything freezes up, everything crashes, everything is paralyzed. Well, Texas is a similar situation. And that has been exacerbated by a lot of economic issues and also by silly ideas like green energy. Texas is what, our number two oil producing state, and they have windmills. Why? Because liberals hate fossil fuels, leftists hate fossil fuels, they want alternative energy. And well, it just turns out that these things are very, very fragile. And so what's happened there is the normal weaknesses of liberal democracy, I think, have been compounded by the late stage liberal democracy problems that we're having. Just the decline, the demographic decline, the rise of left-wing craziness, the proliferation of left-wing craziness, the inability of the society to make rational plans, to provide energy and so forth. And as long as there weren't any emergencies, they could get away with hollowing out Texas's energy system. Of course, there's always going to be an emergency. And when a hollowed out, dumbed down, politically correct facsimile of a first world country suddenly is faced with a test, a stress test, things fall apart. And that's what's happening now. They've been hollowing things out. They've been dumbing things down. They have made the state very, very fragile. And now there are millions of people without power and clean water. People are literally freezing to death. And idiots on coastal liberal hateful idiots are chortling about this, which is another level to the gallingness of this situation. This is what you'd expect in a third world country, and that's what America is becoming. It's becoming that way because of race replacement immigration and what race replacement immigration makes possible, which is the ascendancy of idiots on the left. And idiots will hollow out a system and make it very fragile, and it'll all go swimmingly until there's an emergency, and then it's stress tested and it falls apart. We're seeing that in Texas. But you know, California could be next. California is actually much further down the road to being Mexico, to being third world, than any other state in America. And you know, it can snow in San Diego. It hasn't happened recently, but these freak things happen. So we shall see when California finally gets some kind of serious stress test, just how weak and hollowed out it's become. So from last week, I had a question and a donation, and I overlooked it, and I must apologize, first of all, for that. Stephen sent in, I think it was $10. Let me just look it up here. Stephen, yes, Stephen sent in $20. Thank you very much. And he asked, what did I write my PhD dissertation about, and does it have any ongoing connection to my current philosophical projects? I wrote a PhD dissertation on a book by Immanuel Kant called Dreams of a Spirit Seer. And I thought it was actually very well argued thesis. I thought it was very well written, very thoroughly researched, and it has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm doing now, though. That was a chapter in my life when I did a doctoral dissertation. And in academia, you're supposed to be very, very myopic and grinding and work on a tiny, tiny problem in great, great detail. And that's what I did. But it's really not proved to be continually relevant to what I'm doing. Bryce writes in with $5, would it be possible to update the RSS feed? Oh my God, I'm sorry. I thought that that was fixed. So we will go back to the drawing board, and I will forward this message to our tech guy. We thought we had the RSS stuff fixed up. Bay writes in with $5. Thank you very much. Greg, are you familiar with the work of Korean director Lee Chang-dong? He's one of my favorite recent discoveries. I think Oasis is his best film. I do not know him. I will make a note of it. I have to say something about Korea, South Korea. I visited South Korea in 2004, just briefly, and I really loved it. I thought it was great. Basically, the feel that I had in South Korea was that I was in a place like Denmark or the Netherlands, a high IQ, cold, homogeneous, advanced society. It's just, it was an Asian society, and it had a very unique feel to it. And I liked everything about it. There was just a Korean stamp on it. You would not mistake Korea for Japan or China. It had its own identity, and it was everywhere. There was a kind of unity of style. And so it would not surprise me in the least that there's really good Korean cinema, and I just haven't explored it, but this will be the first Korean cinema that I explore. So Chad writes in with $35. Yes, we will take care of the lightning and the sun for you. Frankie writes in with $10. Thank you very much. Thank you for telling the truth about how things really are. Well, I really appreciate it. Sigur Fryer writes in with $23. That's very generous. Porden Jeterson, I know that's not your real name, writes in with $10 saying trying again. Bay writes in, what do you think about romantic love with a $10 tip? That's very generous. Is it just our brain releasing chemicals to make us commit to and reproduce with someone? Well, I don't think romantic love is something that is, how to put it, determined by the necessities of committing and reproduction. For one thing, romantic love as a basis for pair bonding is a fairly recent thing. It's a Western thing largely, and it's actually associated with low rates of reproduction, weak marriages, and things like that. So I actually think romantic love is one of those sort of flukes that you find in nature that doesn't actually seem to make us more fit for survival in this strict Darwinian sense. I think cultures that have less romanticism, for instance, if you go to India, practically all marriages in India are based on arranged marriages. They're arranged marriages within particular social groups, castes, and communities. That is actually a more reliable way of finding people, mates, and reproducing the society. I think romantic love is not Darwinianly adaptive to be perfectly honest. And I do think that maybe in the future, communities of white people that have a future are going to be less romantic and more focused on other ways of choosing mates and having stable relationships. So that's a really very interesting and good question, though. Solar Temple sends in, whoa, $359. That's very generous. Gadius sends in $20. When my grandma Towers arrives in the mail, I plan to make a proper cuppa, crack open my newly arrived from Amazon copy of White Identity Politics while periodically checking the price of Bitcoin. Stay cozy, friends. That's sounds like a really nice vision. I congratulate you on your good taste and your good sense about Bitcoin. Exocet writes in with $10. All the best to my brothers and sisters. Well, all the best to you as well. Max Anderson writes in with $3. Great show. Thank you very much. Flying Dutchman writes in with $25 again. Thank you. Thanks for having a true fighter on your show. I think he's referring to Laura. And Unknown Californian with $3. Being racially conscious in California, I can't help but bring up race, diversity, and multiculturalism in every conversation I have with my neighbors. I hope my approach is correct. It really depends. That's an interesting question. It really depends on how good you are at talking about this stuff. If you're smooth about it and you don't come off as a crank who's trying to shoehorn this into every discussion, you know, somebody asks you about the price of eggs and you want to talk about diversity, that might be a little clumsy. But if you are smooth at this and you are good at it, I don't see any reason not to. Because guess what? Every other white person in California is aware of white demographic displacement as well. And oftentimes you don't have to say very much about it. You can just signal that you see these things and that you're open to having a conversation, and boy, people will talk. They just will open up to you. I haven't lived in California in more than 10 years. And when I lived in California in the early 2000s and again from 2010 to 2014, I found a lot of receptivity to talking about these things with ordinary Californians. Why? Because it's so obvious what's going on. So I got a question from our favorite cat, Lovecraft's cat, and basically, I can't find it here, but he sends in $3, and the gist of it was, please share your thoughts about the passing of Rush Limbaugh. And that's a really, really good question. I, like a lot of people who are listening to me and a lot of people who read our stuff, I was a Rush Limbaugh fan at one time. I was a big Rush Limbaugh fan. Now, I had a good friend who made a lot of important points to me, helped me discover a lot of things. He was very, very important in my political journey, named Dave. And for years, Dave would talk about how great Rush Limbaugh was. But, you know, I never got into it. I didn't like the idea of sitting and listening to this guy commenting for 3 hours in the afternoon. But I really enjoyed a lot of the things that Dave would tell me about Rush. I remember when Bill Clinton, that smarmy piece of shit, was elected president of the United States. It was a horrible day. I did not think that this creep would get anywhere near the White House. And when he got elected, I was profoundly upset. I thought this is a bad sign for America. Not that George Bush, the first, was all that great, but he was certainly better than this smarmy jackass, this used car salesman from Arkansas. So anyway, the day after Clinton got elected, I turned to Rush Limbaugh for solace, and I listened to him, and I loved it. I thought, this guy is great. He's funny. He's witty. He's aggressive in his own way. He doesn't take bullshit. So I became a real Limbaugh listener for the bulk of the 1990s. And even after I got red-pilled, I would still listen to him from time to time, especially if I was driving somewhere, right, during those hours when he was at the golden EIB microphone. And I loved his parody songs. I loved a lot of his commentary. As I grew in my thinking, I saw limitations to Rush. I became less and less of a neocon. I was always skeptical of free trade arguments. Well, not always. I was a libertarian at one time. But by the time I started listening to Rush, I was over that a long time before. And so I would get really, really irritated. I remember screaming once at the radio, "A tariff is a tax, Rush. It's a tax." You know, I tried to call him when he was talking about free trade and tariffs once. I thought NAFTA was a bad idea. I liked Ross Perot when he emerged on the political scene, and I thought that Rush Limbaugh was extremely unfair to Ross Perot. You know, he had his boomer con, true con, free market conservative problems, blind spots. There's no question about it. And he was also super vain. It was very obvious that he was vain and that there was a lot of wool in his head, and it was child's play to pull it over his eyes, to quote a show that I love, Yes, Prime Minister. And so the Jews really put the squeeze on him to bring him into their camp. I think when he got married for the third time, he and his wife had a honeymoon in Israel. I guess Jack Posobiec got the idea of going on his honeymoon in Israel from Rush Limbaugh. Maybe that's what happened. It's certainly good insurance against being called an anti-Semite, right? Well, anyway, Rush came back babbling Israeli propaganda. And I think that was the last time I really seriously listened to him, except for, you know, cursorily in the background if somebody had him on or if I was on a car journey. So I grew tired of Rush at a certain point. However, when in 2016, Rush Limbaugh went all in for Trump and read on air an essay by Sam Francis, my ears went up. I listened. I thought, this is very, very important. And he really grew. He grew in the direction of nationalism and populism. Now, it's very interesting, in the early 90s, before I was really listening to him, he was a big booster of Patrick Buchanan. He liked Buchanan. Buchanan was, you know, Trump, before Trump was cool, Buchanan was bringing up all the issues that Trump later ran on and won. And Limbaugh liked that, but then he got basically swayed over to the dark side, the Republican establishment, but his better instincts prevailed. And when he saw Trump, he liked Trump. I also think that he just sort of got himself backed into being more and more of a Trump supporter, because even though he might not have initially liked Trump, he liked Ted Cruz at first. I think he saw two things. He saw how unjust and crazy the left was in attacking him and would stick up for him. And I think that he also appreciated Trump's fight. There's a feistiness and a larger-than-life quality about Trump that was very much a quality that I liked in Rush Limbaugh as a figure. So anyway, I never listened to his show again, but I heard about what he did. And I just became no longer a talk radio person, right? I was running countercurrents. I wasn't going to be listening to Rush Limbaugh. I was listening to the right stuff then. So I appreciated what happened, and I thought it was a good sign, because Rush Limbaugh has a huge influence. He was bringing people along and solidifying the support for Trump. He had a very blue-pilled philosophy. You know, it's largely right-wing individualism. He would dog whistle about racial awareness, but he wouldn't defend race realism. He would scoff at anti-Southern bigotry and anti-white bigotry, but he would never be a white identitarian, not really. And so he had his limits. He stayed within the boundaries of polite discourse on the right. He could have done a whole lot more, and I wish he had done a whole lot more. He's dead now. You know, if he was saving his credibility, well, he died with his credibility unspent. He could have spent down some of his cred to deal with more necessary but controversial topics, but he didn't do that. And there's a lesson there for us all. If you are basically pulling your punches and saying, you know, I can't afford to be too frank about this, I need to save my credibility in the system, my viability in the system, whatever. Eventually, if you keep saving it up, you're going to have to spend it someday, right? Because if you die and you've never done it, well, you know, who was the smart one? You outsmarted yourself, right? So, you know, we ultimately are effective not based on what we save, but what we spend. And I wrote a little piece at Countercurrents. It's called Spend Yourself, Save the World, about this. We don't win by saving ourselves. We win by spending ourselves. And Rush was a little too bourgeois, unfortunately. And so he died with all of his credibility intact when he could have fought some really, really important battles and move things further in the right direction. So anyway, that is my two bits about Rush. I'm so glad that he got the Medal of Freedom from Trump. That was a good thing that Trump did. One of a number of very solid things. So goodbye, Rush Limbaugh. I felt really sad when he died. I honestly did, even though I hadn't listened to him in almost 20 years. He was an important part of my intellectual journey, and I think the intellectual journey of a lot of people. And he had a fighting spirit about him that I like and I think is present in many of the people who are commenting on the right today. He really remade talk radio and conservative dissident radio. And that's a legacy that's going to go on for a long, long time. So anyway, that is my thought about Rush. And that was a lot of commentary for US dollars. You got a really good deal out of that one. Mr. Slippery, not his real name, writes in with $20. Will you be at AMRN 2021? There's been a recent debate on IRL activism and events recently. I'd like to hear your thoughts. I would like to go to AMRN 2021. I'm a little worried about travel, and I'm a little worried about persecution, frankly. I'm just really, really anxious about what is being cooked up by the Biden-Harris regime for white advocates. So I will try to be there if I can. I want to be there. I've got lots of friends who are there. It's very, very important for us to go to these things, but you know, COVID willing and the regime willing, I'll be there. I guess that's the way to put it. MP writes in with $50. That's very generous. Thank you. According to Josh Neal, an extremist seeks destruction without any rational thought about creating something new, and a radical is someone who sees destruction as an opportunity to create something new. What are your thoughts on this distinction? Have you read the book? I haven't read his book. So an extremist seeks destruction without any rational thoughts about creating something new. A radical is someone who sees destruction as an opportunity to create something new. Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure how useful that distinction is or why we're casting this in terms of destruction. I don't think you can define an extremist or a radical in terms of their attitudes towards destruction, but you know, I suppose it's one dimension of these phenomena. So I kind of don't know. I'm kind of scratching my head about this, but thank you for very much for that. And maybe something will come to me as I think about this. I'm sure we'll get somebody to review the book, by the way, at Countercurrents. Okay, so I've had a few questions. Eric sent in five questions. I don't think I'm going to go through all five, but I will definitely go through a couple of them. Eric wants to know my favorite comedies. Now, this is actually a really interesting question. I like humor. I have a sense of humor. I like funny people. I don't like most comedies. Why is that? Well, look, I don't like Woody Allen. I don't like Jerry Seinfeld. Okay. I don't like crude comedy. Even if it's funny, I don't like crude comedy. I don't like laughing at stuff that's crude. I don't like Austin Powers comedy, that kind of stuff. But there are some films that I really love that are comedies, and I jotted down a few of them that I highly recommend. These some of these are films that I've actually reviewed. My very favorite comedy is a movie from the 1960s called The Loved One. It's reviewed at Countercurrents. It's actually quite profound, but it's a dark comedy about the American way of death, about the funeral industry in Southern California, based on a novel, The Loved One, by Evelyn Waugh. It's brilliant. It's hilariously funny, but it's very serious and dark and brilliant. Another dark comedy that I really love and highly recommend is With Null and I, and I did a review of that recently. That's up at Countercurrents. A couple other comedies that I like. I'm not a big Mel Brooks fan. I have to say most of his stuff is super, super lame and tasteless. I did actually think that Young Frankenstein was a consistently funny movie, but I don't even want to recommend it that highly. Dr. Strangelove, I guess I'd call that comedy. It's dark comedy. It's very memorable. There's one sci-fi parody film, comic film, that I actually think is extremely brilliant. It's really well done. It makes great fun of basically Trekkies. It's Galaxy Quest. I thought that was an extremely clever and well-constructed film. Now, I do like some British comedy series, and I want to share some of those with you. Absolutely Fabulous. The first four seasons, all the rest of it's worthless, but the first four seasons of Absolutely Fabulous are really brilliant satire. And basically, it's brilliant satire about the left. I think it's objectively rightist and red-pilled. It's a portrayal of, it's really a portrayal of our neoliberal elite, because the figures of Edwina Monsoon and Patsy Stone, they're hyper-materialist leftist hedonists, right? They're New Labor all the way. They're Bill Clinton. They are Hillary Clinton. They are the neoliberal establishment of today. And this was done in the 90s, and it's extremely funny. And it just shows the emptiness, the silliness of these people. And it's brilliant cutting satire on a whole generation of entitled, narcissistic people who are leftists, entitled, materialist, narcissist, leftist types. And we're living in their world now, and it's a nightmare, and it's really funny to see them get theirs. Another brilliant British comedy is Fawlty Towers. It's almost slapstick, and in fact, it is slapstick in some ways, and I'm generally not into slapstick, but it's utterly brilliant satire. There's a brilliant British comedy series, two series. One is called Yes Minister, and the other is Yes Prime Minister. They're very funny, but they're very deep satires about politics in Great Britain, bureaucracy and politics. They're highly educational. And at the same time, they're extremely entertaining. So those are some things I will recommend. I recommend The Loved One and With Null and I. I really recommend Galaxy Quest. Watch Absolutely Fabulous, the first four seasons. Watch Fawlty Towers. Yes, Minister. Yes, Prime Minister. That's fantastic stuff. I got another question about favorite cuisines. Okay. Sure, why not? Italian and French. Those are the top two. I also love Hungarian food. I think it's fantastic. It's very unique and exotic right in the middle of Europe. I like Japanese food. That's the only non-Western cuisine that I'm going to list in like my top five, but I like Japanese food, but I think we all have a little exception for the Japanese, a little soft spot. All those anime fans out there will agree with me. And I can't really think of a fourth, except that I just want to say I really like Euro peasant food. And it's not necessarily one country or another, but I like Euro peasant food, especially game dishes, cabbage dishes, things like that, the kinds of sausages that you get. It's just such good food. Terrines, potted meats and things like that. All of this stuff is peasant fare, and it's just so wholesome and good. I really, really like that. I also like just anywhere along the coast of Europe where people are pulling fish out of the sea. When I was in Norway, I loved getting Norwegian fish everything. And they also serve whale, which I thought was really interesting. I actually ate whale in Norway. So I don't have really fancy tastes in food. I like good food, but I kind of like simple peasant food or fisherman food from Europe. And, Japanese food at its best is that way too. But the sort of high cuisines, I guess, Italian and French food and Hungarian, those are my favorites. I would also love, if I'm going out to a restaurant, Russian restaurants, Ukrainian restaurants, there's some great food at those places. It's interesting. The best food I ever had in England was at a Polish restaurant. I think it was called Agnieszka. And it was a restaurant that was in the former Polish Army Officer Club during the Second World War. And it's still there. And they served more country nobility cuisine, the kind of stuff that Polish officers would enjoy. Lots of really good game dishes and things like that, rabbit and goose and venison and so forth. That's really the best meal I ever had in Great Britain. So the best Italian food I've ever had on the continent was in Norway, interestingly enough. Anyway, so those are a few thoughts. I'm going to run through the DLive chat just to make sure that I'm not missing anybody here. I really like traditional food in Scandinavia. Yeah, somebody mentioned that. That's a lot of fish, a lot of good fish food in Scandinavia. Okay, good newish British series is Detectorist. We actually ran a review of that at Countercurrents, but I haven't seen it. Okay. You'd love to see Josh Neal here some Sunday. That may be possible. Anything with Peter Cook, Woody Allen, Seinfeld, Mel Brooks. I can't put my finger on it. Yeah, right. I honestly like Larry David. I have to admit that I've watched, I think, the first four seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and there's some brilliant stuff in there. I mean, there is some good Jewish comedy, but generally I just don't like these people, and their comedy is at my expense. The thing that I love the most about Larry David is that it's more self-depreciating Jewish comedy, and I very much enjoy that stuff. So, I don't love Sarah Silverman. I don't even think she's funny. I'm glad Gadius linked Robert Hampton on Rush. And if somebody could link the piece that Gregory Hood wrote on Rush Limbaugh that's over at American Renaissance, that's well worth reading too. I basically had the same take that they did. We had the same experience. We all felt really sad when he died, even though we had parted ways with him a long time ago. And we all were very impressed with his populist turn from 2015 forward. And now that Rush is dead, they're calling him an anti-Semitic, neo-Nazi, white supremacist anyway. All the virtue signaling was a waste of time. How do the Greek left perceive ancient Greece? That's a good question. I don't know. I think they'd have to be embarrassed by it, frankly, because it's certainly not very leftist. It's so healthy. I mean, what is the Greek left today? I'm sure a lot of them are transsexuals and blob blobby, unhealthy people like they are in the rest of the world. Every statue from ancient Greece is a complete repudiation of these people. It's like a metaphysical repudiation of them. They have to hate it, frankly, I would think. So Trump called Pat a far-right anti-Semite. Yeah, he did a long time ago. He made up with Pat Buchanan, which was a good move. Buchanan is a great guy, and he is sort of an anti-Semite, objectively. Especially if you use the definition of anti-Semite that was given by Joe Sobran. An anti-Semite used to mean somebody who hated Jews. Now an anti-Semite just means somebody that Jews hate. By that standard, Rush Limbaugh was an anti-Semite too, because Jews really didn't like the guy. F for L. Rushbow. Yeah, I agree. I feel very sad that he's gone. I just wish he could have done more. He could have done more. I wish he had done more. You know, for years I was saying that all we needed was one person like Rush Limbaugh. He always was the first one who came to mind. Some public figure who transgresses the boundaries of political correctness and stands his ground. That could have been a game-changing thing. If he would have said, you know, it's okay to be white, convince me otherwise. That'll be a game-changing historical moment. And this brings me to another question here, which is about the recent appearance of Heather McDonald on Tucker Carlson's show. I was asked to comment about that. It was a couple days ago. I watched a rerun, so I don't know which day it was. But Tucker was basically talking about all this critical race theory stuff, this anti-white stuff. And a lot of it's completely crazy. And he had on Heather McDonald. Heather McDonald works at the Manhattan Institute. She's written a lot about policing and so forth. She's written about Black Lives Matter and how it's produced spikes in crime. She knows everything important. And basically, she did two things that were very important. One was quite explicit. She said, this is simply anti-white. Okay, that's important. She simply identified what's going on here as anti-white. All this critical race theory stuff, Black Lives Matter, all this jibber-jabber, what unites it all is that it's anti-white. It's an attempt to stigmatize and harm white people. That's all there is to it. That I thought was important for the Overton window. The other thing she said, in not such explicit terms, unfortunately, was that since we are being attacked, white people are being attacked as racists because of the failures, the spectacular failures of black people to achieve things, even in a system that's massively stacked in their favor. Since we are being blamed for their failures, since differential outcomes are basically being blamed on white ill will, we have to talk about other explanations for this. Okay, well, what are the other explanations for black failure despite black privilege other than evil white people keeping the black man down? Obviously, you're going to have to talk about race realism. She didn't just go there straight away, but it was very, very important. This was on Tucker Carlson last week. That, I think, is a sea change kind of thing. That's important. I want one of these politicians to say things, something like to be attacked on it's okay to be white and say, what's wrong with it's okay to be white, and stand his ground. That would be absolutely crucial. If Josh Hawley really wants to get the left frothing, you know, it'd be great if he says it's okay to be white. The picture of him with it raising his fist at the Capitol protesters is a iconic image. It's a great image. He looks like a fighter. I would love it if that were true, right? And that he would actually stand up for something like that, because It's the simplest thing in the world to say it's okay to be white. Everybody should be willing to say that. And yet we can't say it. And yet we're supposedly living in a white supremacist society. We live in a white supremacist society. And yet my book, It's Okay to Be White, cannot be sold on the biggest book-selling platforms in our white supremacist society. It's a refutation of the white supremacy claim, basically. The fact that you can't say it's okay to be white is proof positive that the critical race theory dogma that this is a white supremacist society is a false claim. That's what's so beautiful about that meme. If politicians and pundits, mainstream figures, basically say it's okay to be white and defend it, that is amazing. I would debate Jim on Pulp Fiction. If you want, Jim, I would love to talk about Pulp Fiction with you. I think it's a profound movie. I don't like Quentin Tarantino at all, but somehow he blundered into making an absolutely profound film. I have a very big essay on it at Countercurrents, and there's also a lecture I gave back in 2000, I think, that I edited up that's on Countercurrents as well. So let me zip over to Entropy and see if we have some more people here. More questions, more comments, more donations. Yes, they're rolling in. Nicephorus writes in with $3. Greg, to what extent, if at all, do you subscribe to the doctrine of the Kali Yuga? Countercurrents used to be subtitled Books Against Time, suggesting the influence from Savitri Devi. Well, the Kali Yuga is basically it means the dark age. Kali means dark and Yuga means age. And the Kali Yuga is the Hindu version of this perennial idea of the dark age, the idea that we begin in an Edenic golden age and then we descend, we decline through history to a dark age. And then the dark age, because it's dark and dark things, chaotic things can't sustain themselves, will collapse, and then we will enter a golden age again. I've always liked that myth, that symbol, for two reasons. First of all, it coincides with my experience of history. There is progress in history. Generally, it's technological. And somebody like Savitri Devi didn't deny that there was technological progress, but she denied that in the moral realm, there was progress. And instead, she thought that mankind morally and even biologically declined over time. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I like it because it's a rejection of progressivism, which is, I think, a patently silly idea, but it's one of the sustaining myths of the left. I think that the decline view is a myth as well, but it's closer to the truth. I also like the idea that history moves in cycles, and that at the end of the gold of the dark age is the beginning of something new. So, you know, we are in the belly of a dark age right now. There's no question about it. And if we go deeper into decadence, we will come out the other side, because decadence is not something that can sustain itself. It's unhealthy. I mean, that's what decadence really means. It just means something that's unhealthy, that can't sustain itself. And once it liquidates itself from its own corruptions, expires of its own corruptions, it will make room for something new. Now, the form of that doctrine that I subscribe to is not the mythical form. If you look at the Hindus, right, they have very fanciful idea of the golden age, and the ancient Greeks had a very fanciful idea of the golden age too. They believed that the golden age was a time of wisdom where people lived in harmony with nature and knew deep truths. They were all wise men, basically. My view of this is based on Vico, Gian Battista Vico, and there's an essay and a lecture at Countercurrents on Vico and the New Right that I recommend. Vico was a materialist of sorts. He was an Epicurean, and he believed that the golden age for man would be an age of a primitive man, not civilized, but very primitive. But it's a golden age in terms of its vitality. It's not golden in terms of culture, what he called abstruse and recondite wisdom. It's golden in the sense that it is vital, because the mind isn't clouded by false ideas or any ideas at all. It's very vital. And then what happens is, as the mind progresses, we actually decline. We progress in terms of ideas and inventions, but we decline in terms of vitality and health. And therefore, you can have both progress and decline at the same time. And what happens, though, is at the end of a cycle, we go back to the beginning. Basically, degeneracy and corruption make society unsustainable, and therefore, there's a crash. And what happens in the crash is the liquidation of the false ideas and the reassertion of vitality. So I think that cyclical view of history is actually very much consistent with biology, with actual natural history, and with observable social trends. So I'm very, very strongly for that. So Nicephorus also sends in just $25 as a separate donation. Thank you very much. Anne Frank Rizzo writes in, that's a great name, with $10. Thank you. Greg, I'm curious if there's a particular system of ethics or eudaimonistic philosophy that you find applicable within white nationalism. Well, you know, I talk a bit about ethics in my latest book, White Identity Politics. And basically, you know, I am a eudaimonist, okay? I like this idea of self-actualization, but I make the point, and this is a point that Aristotle understood, that there are lots of different ways of actualizing potential, and you only want to actualize your good potential, not your potential for laziness, not the potential to be Hannibal Lecter or Jeffrey Dahmer, right? But yeah, I'm ultimately very much influenced by classical Greek ethics, which has this element of self-actualization in it. And I think that Plato and Aristotle are extremely consistent with what we want in terms of an analysis of human nature and politics and the advocacy in Aristotle of the mixed regime. I think Aristotle's model of the mixed regime is a great model for how I would organize society in the future. Yeah, and Glorious Bastards is a terrible, terrible film. I wrote a brilliant review of that, actually, though, which is up at Countercurrents. Yeah, Tarantino comes off, this is Jim Goad, like he's been watched 2 million violent movies, but has never been punched in the face. He's highly punchable. That guy is really very punchable. Norwegian traditional food regularly gets prizes. I believe it. I loved food in Scandinavia. In Denmark, everything that I ate in Denmark was fantastic. I would go into the coffee shop at a museum and get a croissant. It was like the best croissant I ever had. The coffee would be 4 stars. It was everywhere you would go. The quality of food was as excellent. And I had the same experience in Holland too. And in Sweden and in Norway. In Norway, though, the sticker shock was a bit much. That is the most expensive place I've ever been. You know, it's the land of the $20 salad. So anyway, okay, there are a couple more little questions here. Let me just get them. Eric asks, what's my favorite holiday? Christmas. Absolutely. I love Christmas. What would be my second favorite holiday? Well, another family holiday is Thanksgiving. Just for the family stuff. I'm not a big turkey lover, okay? But Christmas and Thanksgiving, I really love. I like, you know, Halloween when I was a kid for obvious reasons. What are my top 5 favorite novels? That's a really very good question, and I think I can come up with that very, very quickly. My And it's hard to say what my number one favorite novel is, but I will come up with five that certainly belong near the top of the list. I love Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel, 100 Years of Solitude. Absolutely ravishing work of the imagination. Just truly remarkable. Another that I really love is D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. And this is hard because it's actually really kind of flabby as a novel. I wish that he had edited it. I wish that he had cut like 20% out of it, actually. But at the same time, it's so beautiful, so beautifully written, and so filled with profound ideas that I have to forgive him the fact that it just goes on a bit long. I love Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. It's just a truly overwhelmingly brilliant work of the imagination. There's no equaling it. It's really quite good. I am trying to think of a couple others. Okay, another that I really very much love is The Leopard. Which I actually wrote a review of Visconti's film of The Leopard as Trevor Lynch, where I talk about the novel as well. And I think that is a truly magnificent novel. I really like it a lot. Another novel that I really like, and I think it's underrated by critical types, is The Fountainhead. I really love Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. I've read it a number of times. I've reread it a number of times, and it stands up. And I guess a sixth novel that I've read a number of times and I really love is Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, her first novel. And I, as Trevor Lynch, wrote a review of John Huston's movie of Wise Blood that's at Countercurrents as well. And of course, I talk about the book as well as the film. So those are six that I can really, really highly recommend. And I'm sure if I were, asked another time, I'd probably come up with slightly different rankings and things like that. But those are definitely six novels that I want to reread before I die. Let me put it that way. Okay, and I'm just going to see if there are any others, and then we're going to wrap up because we are almost to the end of our second hour. What do you see Countercurrents doing as Zog falls apart? More of the same, but better. I really think that we are doing the right thing, which is promoting ideas, building community, showing the relevance of what we believe to what's going on today. We have the best account of what's wrong with the world. We have the best alternative. We know how to fix it. That is what we have to keep saying, and we have to keep getting that message out to more and more people. That's very, very important. So we're doing the right thing. We just need to do more of it. We need to do better. We need to reach more people, and that's how we change things. So as Zog falls apart, we feast on Zog falling apart, right? The more disasters they create, the more grist for our mill and the more people who are being driven in our direction. We profit from their decline. We're shorting Zog, okay? We are shorting Zog by profiting from its decline, and its decline is inevitable because it's based on lies, and whenever you act on lies, you create disasters, and then disasters require cover-ups, and so on and so forth. So we just never... they just keep it giving us great material. That's what's happening. So we profit from their decline tremendously. I think there are a couple more people writing in. Okay, at Entropy. MP, what are your favorite games? Would you ever do a gaming stream? I have never played a video game, if that's the kind of game you're talking about. I don't think anybody would watch a stream of me playing solitaire, right? I'm just not a game person. I actually created a game when I was in school. And it was I think fifth grade or something like that. It was a board game, and it got lost and I couldn't recreate it. But it was actually kind of a brilliant board game. So I wish I wish that I could recreate that, but I don't play video games. I just don't have time. I have this gaming laptop and I got it because of the processor speed and the memory and stuff like that. And I was on an airplane and this young Zoomerish guy was sitting next to me. He was from England and I opened my laptop and he saw I had this gaming laptop and he said, "So what's your favorite game?" And I said, "Well, it's one you haven't heard of. But what I do is I'm part of this vast conspiracy of people all over the world. We're literally fighting to save civilization from being destroyed by the forces of evil. And the best thing about it is that it's all true." And he didn't say, "Oh, please tell me about your game." He obviously realized I was some kind of crank or something like that. But anyway, it was worth a shot. But MP sends $5 with that, so thank you very much. Going to check one more time to see if anybody else has tossed in some stuff through my other social media channels. Well, folks, I think we have done it. We're going to call this a show. So we had a question earlier. When is Jim Goad going to be coming on again? Well, I asked him because he's in the comment. It's a very cozy stream here. We have lots of friends in the comments. I asked Jim if he'd come on next week, and he'll come on, and maybe we'll talk about Pulp Fiction together and a bunch of other stuff. But so next week will be Jim Goad, and I'm trying to work out for the week after that. It might be Dark Enlightenment, and we're going to be talking about urbanism, but we haven't firmed that up yet. But there's a lot of great people out there to talk to. Again, they're always giving us great things to comment on, so there will always be another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So thank you.